thing. I want to say the Christian faith is simple. There's the big message today. The Christian faith is simple. Deep and profound, but it's actually very simple. It's not always easy to see how simple it is because of 2,000 years of church history. It's been like kind of a rolling stone gathering moss and so on, and or like painting. Do you know, I'm told that this is so, that the Oval Office of the White House is painted every time a new president comes in. And so a new level layer of paint gets put on the walls, put on the walls, put on the walls. And after decades, centuries, whatever of that, they eventually, at some point a little while ago, got paint scrapers out and scraped it all back to the raw to begin again. And beneath the layers of paint, they discovered plaster impressions on the walls of animals and, you know, the bald eagle, and which is just a seagull. Anyway, but, you know, these kind of majestic creatures around the walls of the White House. Now, I don't know if actually that's true. I did some research this morning. I Googled it once, and I couldn't see any kind of comment about myth at all, so I assume it's okay. But anyway, the point is simply this, that when things kind of add up again and again, the paint, you start to lose what's actually the simple thing behind it all. And the Bible is like that. Well, the Christian message is like that. After 2,000 years, there's been paint. There's been Christians who have run off in this direction, and there's religious communities run off, and people in the community add, and so on and so forth. Slowly, it gets harder and harder to see what the Christian faith is. The simple message is this. If you get the paint scraper of the Bible, think of the Bible as a paint scraper, you scrape all the paint back off, and here's the simple message. It's all about who Jesus is and what you do with him. It's all about who Jesus is and what you do with him. That message is so simple and straightforward. It's about who Jesus is and that you are to respond by faith with that Jesus. Now, just notice that for a moment, actually, the talk of faith. You see, it's very simple. In its first expression of it, see who Jesus is and put your faith in him. In the first century, that was very simple. But in our day and age, that's much more complex because of 2,000 years of church history around the language of faith. Also around the language of who Jesus is, but around the language of faith. If there's one idea that's more confused than many, it is that idea of faith today. So when I use that language of faith, what do most people in our community think? I'll give you my thoughts. I talk to people and they think, oh, you've just got to have faith. And what they mean is you've just got to kind of close your mind, close your eyes to all the evidence and just jump and believe in this religious experience. Don't think, don't try to wrestle with, just have faith. And it's kind of an inner thing. You've got to look within and kind of stir up this emotion, this experience. It's not about evidence. In fact, it's usually religious faith is understood to be the very thing you have when you've got no evidence. Now, with that kind of sense of things, when you come to the Bible and it talks about faith, the danger is you can read all of that 2,000 years of the way we think about it back into the Bible and confuse what is very simple, make it very distorted and messed up. And so my aim today is to take us right back to the beginning, the foundational book, Matthew's Gospel, the paint scraper, scrape off all the guff and the rubbish and get back to the simple message of the Christian faith, which is, who is Jesus and what do you do with him? Who is Jesus and what do you do with him? Now, for some of you today, that'll be a great relief. Some of you, as we go back to the simplicity of it, you'll go, that's all it is. I see that. I can do that. For others of you, it'll be a shock. It'll be a kind of a challenge. You go, that's not how I want it to be. I like my kind of religion, whatever you've... And so you'll find it a challenge. But either way, we need to come back to what it actually says. We're going in this by looking at this book of Matthew. It's a new series we're starting today. We'll be doing it over the next term. And of course, we started the book last year. We did the first 7 chapters. And today, as we start, we're kind of jumping... kind of partway through series 2, episode 3. Do you know what I mean? So we've got a lot of stuff we've picked up last year that you may not have been around for. Others, of course, were. So it's good to do a refresh. If you were around last year and you've kind of, all this is very familiar, you can have a little bit of a mental rest. Don't look at Facebook on your phone, though. A quick rest and as I unpack for this for us all. So the book of Matthew, quick background. Who's it written by? Very good, very easy. We start with the easy questions first. Matthew was one of the first followers of Jesus. We actually had the reading where he was called by Jesus to follow him. He was a tax collector. Matthew is a man who had been with Jesus, called from the very early stages to see his kind of public work and ministry down through his life, up to his death and then resurrection. And on the way through, Matthew kind of saw some things about Jesus, was kind of growing in his amazement, but didn't really quite understand it until after the death and then resurrection, it all made sense. And having now all made sense, he went all the way back through and rethought what had gone on. Do you know, have you ever had an experience of meeting a famous person? Some of you have had brushes with fame. I read years ago about a man on a plane. He was sitting next to someone and reading a book. And he was reading this book. Unbeknownst to him, the man sitting next to him was the author of that book. You know, there's a very famous author whose name I can't now remember. But, you know, he sold millions of copies and so on. But they're sitting together through this plane flight and talking as he's kind of got his book open and whatever. And at one point, the man says to him, so what do you think of the book? And the bloke reading it says, well, you know, I think he starts well, but I don't think he's got a good grasp of language and his kind of plot is a bit thin and, you know, talking back and forth. And the man's, oh, is that right? And how do you think he could improve it? And they chatted together all the way to the end of the flight. And as the plane landed and they were getting off, the author stood up and sort of dropped a card in his lap and walked off. And the man read the card and it was, I don't know, it was Arthur Haley or something like this, author. And he went, ah. Now, you know what he did just then? He went all the way back through the conversation to see what had been said. And he recalibrated everything that had went on, do you see? Oh, when he said that, that was because... Oh, that's Matthew. That's Matthew. Matthew gets to the end of this experience with Jesus and the resurrection was like God dropping a card in his lap. God has been amongst you. And Matthew goes, ah. Oh. And so now writes the account from that kind of experience of looking back on it and gives us insight into the things that have occurred all the way through so that you as quickly as possible might see who Jesus is and know how to respond to him. That's the book. And as you read it again and again, you actually begin to see that Matthew has carefully crafted his account. This is not just someone who's kind of dropped words on a page. He wants to carefully take us through the history of what occurred, but in a way that it stirs us to see the significance of it, that we might have faith. And you begin to see there's a flow, a structure, a pattern. And I'll give it to you. Very broadly, it falls into two halves. It's the first half is kind of chapter 1 to 16. And that chapter 16 marks a change point because up to chapter 16, it's been Jesus saying and doing things and people puzzled and responding and... At the end of chapter 16, Jesus says, so who do the people say I am? And Peter says, you are the Messiah. Bang. And from that point on, Jesus says, he begins to teach them that the Son of Man must now go to Jerusalem, suffer many things at the hands of the chief and be killed and then on the third day rise again. And so the second half is this new shift in Jesus revealing the depths of what he's going to be and do with his death and resurrection. So it's broadly speaking, it's got two halves to it. But within those first 16 chapters, which is what we'll be looking at over the next couple of months, you can break it down further. The first four chapters are his infancy and preparation. You get the first two chapters, his kind of genealogy, his infancy narrative. The second two chapters are his kind of baptism, his wilderness experience. He's beginning to preach and a summary of what he says and does. And then you get from chapter four, the beginnings of Matthew showing us the kinds of stuff Jesus did. Let me come with me to Matthew chapter 4, verse 23. Matthew 4, verse 23. So, infancy, account of how he was born, the beginnings of his ministry, that he begins to preach, verse 17, from that time on, Jesus began to preach, repent for the kingdom of heaven. So he's beginning, calls some disciples, and then verse 23. Jesus went throughout Galilee, teaching in their synagogues, proclaiming the good news of the kingdom, and healing every disease and sickness among the people. News about him spread all over Syria, and the people brought to him all those who were ill with various diseases, suffering severe pain, demon-possessed, and so on. What you have here is Matthew kind of lobs in at chapter 4, verse 23, a quick summary of all that Jesus did. Come over to chapter 9, 35. Jesus went through all the towns and villages, teaching in their synagogues, proclaiming the good news of the kingdom and healing every disease and sickness. Have you heard those words before? They're exactly the words from chapter 4, verse 23. And what Matthew does is this. He kind of bookends. At one end he goes, here's a summary of what Jesus did in Galilee, the northern region. He went through all the towns, teaching in the synagogues, proclaiming the good news of the kingdom, healing every disease and sickness. And then he says at the end, chapter 9, verse 35, you see what Jesus did? He went all through Galilee, teaching and proclaiming and healing. And between those two points, Matthew goes, here's a taste of all that he did. He went teaching, chapter 5 to 7, the Sermon on the Mount. He went healing, chapter 8 to chapter 9. Now, we're focusing on chapters 8 and 9 today, but that puts it in context. It fits within Matthew saying, I want you to know who this man is, and I want you to respond rightly, and you need to see what he did. He taught like no other man has taught. Have a look with me at chapter 7, the end of chapter 7, verse 28. When Jesus had finished saying these things, the crowds were amazed at his teaching, because he taught as one who had authority, not as the teachers of the law. The crowds heard Jesus teach. Matthew has actually kind of put a packaged record of his teaching for us, the Sermon on the Mount, chapters 5 to 7. Remember, he goes through all Galilee teaching. Here's a chunk of his teaching. And the crowds are astonished. The crowds have never heard anything like this kind of teaching before. And I tell you what, 2,000 years later, people have still never heard teaching like that before. Chapters 5 to 7 is regarded as some of the most profound insights ever given. Extraordinary teachings. And here's the thing. Isn't that exactly what you expect if Jesus is who he says he is? If Jesus is God come amongst us in the flesh, if he is not just Israel's king, but the incarnate God walking the planet, and he sat down and taught, if he sat down and taught, what would you expect his teaching to be like? Mind-blowing. Profound. Deep and insightful. Life-changing. And that's exactly how the crowds found his teaching to be. And Matthew is saying, look at how he taught. And now he goes, chapter 8, look at what he did. And for the next two chapters, there's incident after incident reported for us by Matthew of the way Jesus engaged with people who were sick, demon-possessed, the people struggling and so on. This is how Jesus engaged, and he gives us two chapters. If you follow it through the next two chapters, you'll see there's three cycles of three miracles that Matthew puts together with some teaching, as you flow through. And Matthew's point in it all is the simple one of see who this man is, see him for who he is, and so respond to him as you ought. How ought you respond? With faith. With faith. That language of faith is sprinkled throughout these episodes, these incidents that are reported for us, because there is a concern to grow faith in us, whatever it is. That's what I want to get to. Let me show you how it's sprinkled through. Have a look with me at the second of that first package of miracles, chapter 8, verse 5. Chapter 8, verse 5, it's the centurion. When Jesus had entered Capernaum, let's spend just a moment on this. When Jesus had entered Capernaum, a centurion came to him asking for help. Lord, he said, my servant lies at home paralyzed, suffering terribly. Jesus said to him, shall I come and heal him? The centurion replied, Lord, I don't deserve to have you come under my roof. Now, why not? Because he's probably almost certainly a Gentile, a non-Jew. Jesus is a Jewish teacher. and the Gentiles didn't associate and so on. He's aware that he's not worthy of the Jewish rabbi, Lord, coming under his roof. But just say the word and my servant will be healed. For I myself am a man under authority with soldiers under me. I tell this one go and he goes, and that one come and he comes, and I say to my servant do this and he does it. When Jesus heard this, he was amazed and said to those following him, truly I tell you, I've not found anyone in Israel with such great faith. He ought to expect in Israel there be such faith, because here is their God come to earth as the King of Israel, and you would expect the Israelites would have responded with faith, whatever that is. But he doesn't find faith among them. He finds it rather among the non-Jews. Verse 11, I say to you that many will come from the east and west, from the Gentile lands, and they'll take their places at the feast with Abraham, Isaac and Jacob, with the great fathers of Israel. They'll take their place in the family of Israel. Verse 12, but the subjects of the kingdom, the Israelites, will be thrown out into the darkness where there'll be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Then Jesus said to the centurion, go, let it be done just as you believed or had faith, the same word. The word in Greek can be translated as the word believe or have faith, whatever those things mean. And his servant was healed at that moment. There's an experience of Jesus. Matthew kind of lobs in this incident and he says, here's Jesus in action. Look what he does. Look at who he is. But look what he's calling for. Faith. You get it again in verse 23 of chapter 8. Then they got into a boat and his disciples followed him. Suddenly a furious storm came up on the lake and the waves swept over the boat, but Jesus was sleeping. The disciples went and woke him, saying, Lord, save us, we're going to drown. He replied, you of little faith, why are you so afraid? Then he got up and rebuked the wind and the waves, and it was completely calm. The men who were amazed and asked, what kind of man is this that even the wind and the waves obey him? The disciples are terrified. They wake up Jesus. With a word, he calms it and he says, why do you have such little faith? There it is again, whatever it is. You see it again there in chapter 9. Flip over to chapter 9, verse 27. As Jesus went out from there, two blind men followed him, calling out, have mercy on us, son of David, the great king of Israel, finally come. Have mercy on us. When he had gone indoors, the blind men came to him and he asked them, do you believe that I'm able to do this? Yes, Lord, they replied. Then he touched their eyes and said, according to your faith, let it be done to you. And their sight was restored. There it is again, faith. All the way through these episodes, Jesus is showing who he is and teaching what needs to be the response towards him. It's faith. But that begs the question, what is faith? What is this thing? Back in its day, it was very simple. This could just land in an area and people go, ah, faith, yes, I know. But in our day and age, there's been so many centuries of paint painted on the Christian wall, if you like, that it's hard to actually know what faith means anymore. And in fact, for some people, faith just means positive thinking. So I was, this some years ago now, was a couple I'd heard of. She had been diagnosed with cancer. And we just keep praying for those around us who are suffering this way. But she'd been diagnosed with cancer, a very aggressive form of cancer. She only had 6 months to live. But they were told by well-meaning Christians that if she just has faith, she will be healed. And so have faith, don't doubt. After 6 months, she died. But the husband was angry, not with God, but with his wife. Why? Because she failed to have the faith that would have healed. Faith for them was this idea of positive thinking. Have faith in yourself. Just think positive and think positive without any negativity. Don't ever speak negative words. And if I don't get my life polluted with negative words, then it'll all happen for me. Faith has just become positive thinking. Is that what Jesus is talking about? Is that the response that he's calling for? Positive thinking. See, when you don't have this thing called faith, how do you get it? Well, if faith is that religious experience that you just have by stepping into the dark with no evidence around you, then how do you get that? You know, do I have to just go to church and just get caught up in the singing in such a way that it just happens to me? How do I get this thing called faith? These are the questions that people have around the place. So let's go back to the Matthew's gospel, go back to the paint scraper and see what it actually is. Come back with me to the centurion and let's try and drop out the language of faith and pick up from all the language around it what it means. So, verse 5, chapter 8. When Jesus had entered Capernaum, a centurion came to him asking for help. "Lord," he said, "my servant lies at home paralyzed, suffering terribly." Jesus said, "Shall I come and heal him?" The centurion replied, Lord, I don't deserve to have you come under my roof, but just say the word and my servant will be healed. For I myself am a man under authority with soldiers under me. I tell this one go and he goes, and that one come and he comes. When Jesus heard this, he was amazed and said to those following, "Truly I tell you, I have not found anyone in Israel with such great faith." Now here's our exercise. What did Jesus see that he calls faith? So give us your thoughts. What did he see? There'll be a bunch of things. What did he see in the centurion that he identified as faith? Trust. Unquestioning confidence. A recognition that Jesus had the power and the authority to do what was being asked. A belief in him. Humility. You add that package together. The centurion comes in humility, recognizing that he is Lord. The centurion's not. That he is Lord with the authority and power to do all things. He comes recognizing that he is Lord, and if just a word from him will heal his servant. He has confidence that Jesus could do that. He trusts Jesus. He comes in humility towards him. There's a sense of awe and regard, respect, belief. And it's that package that Jesus describes as faith. Trusting me, recognizing who I am, having the humility to come and entrust yourself to me. Faith. Come to the storm, chapter 8, verse 23. And again, let's drop the word faith and just see how it works. Then he got into a boat and his disciples followed him. Suddenly a furious storm came up on the lake so that the waves swept over the boat. But Jesus was sleeping. What is with this guy? The disciples went and woke him saying, "Lord, save us, we're going to drown." He replied, "You of little faith, why are you so afraid?" Then he gets up, rebukes the wind and the waves, and it was completely calm. You of little faith, why are you so afraid? Okay, drop the word faith. What does it mean to have much faith? What is the thing that Jesus sees is lacking in them? Give us your thoughts.
I don't get who he is yet, but he was never at risk.
Yes. They don't get who this man is, that they were never at risk. Come back with him to Psalm 107. Yes, when you get it, it's extraordinarily powerful, isn't it? Come back to Psalm 107. Look at verse 1. "Give thanks to the Lord, for he is good. His love endures forever." Give thanks to the Lord. The word Lord there is all in capitals, which tells you it's the Hebrew word for Yahweh, Jehovah, God. Okay, and it talks about those that are redeemed by Yahweh, Jehovah, God. And one of the episodes of redemption is there in verse 23, if you like, one of the episodes of being rescued. Verse 23. "Some went out on the sea in ships. They were merchants on the mighty waters. They saw the works of the Lord God, his wonderful deeds in the deep, for he spoke and stirred up a tempest that lifted high the waves. They mounted to the heavens and went down to the depths. In their peril," the mariners, Their courage melted away. They reeled and staggered like drunkards, the sailors. They were at their wits' end. Then they cried out to God in their trouble, and he brought them out of their distress. He stilled the storm to a whisper. The waves of the sea were hushed. They were glad when it grew calm, and he guided them to the desired haven. Let us give thanks to God for his unfailing love. Jesus stands up and he says, "Quiet, be still." And the storm hushes. And they say to themselves, verse 27, "What kind of man is this that even the wind and the waves obey him?" Do you see what they're wrestling with? Who is the one that we know calms the storm in the Old Testament? It's God. Who have we got in the boat with us? If only they'd known who it was. If they'd had any conception of who was asleep, why is Jesus asleep in the boat? Well, because he's tired, right? He needs a sleep, right? But he couldn't care less. That's right. God has taken on flesh with the limitations and all of the, and so he gets thirsty, he gets tired, which is the humility of God to enter the world like this. But he's asleep in the back of the boat because it doesn't matter what the storm does. He's the God who sent the boundaries to the waves. He's the God who spoke and the universe came to be. And if the disciples had any conception who was in the back of the boat with them, they'd be asleep as well. Do you know what I mean? Like, why are you so afraid? Jesus is astonished. "Don't you know who I am yet?" And he gets up and he speaks a word. "Hush, be still."
No,
they woke him with some... That's why he says, "You of little faith." They have enough faith to come and say, "Lord, someone's got to do something. You probably are the one." But they don't quite know what's going to happen, which is why he goes, "Why are you afraid? You should have come to me like the centurion came, with confidence and assurance that I could do whatever needs to be done." So faith, but little faith, astonished. Yeah. Yes. Yes, so they've got enough to know that he can do something, but I don't think they ever had a clue that... Isn't this interesting? What a church. This is great. This is good. Let's do it. It's helpful. That's right. So he recognizes that he can do something for them, but I don't think they had a clue that he was going to stand up and calm the storm. Do you know, it's like when you're a little kid and the hail's coming down, the floods are rising. You turn to your dad, who's got no clue what to do anyway, but you know he's got to do something. There's that kind of thing going on with them. Yeah, absolutely. But that's why verse 27, they're astonished, even still. "We thought you could do something. We just didn't think you could do that." Do you know what I mean? So I'm having a real disaster up the top of you. But do you want to ask anything else at this moment? That is very good. Let me say, in all of this, faith keeps figuring. Verse 28, your faith, according to verse 29, "According to your faith," chapter 9, "let it be done to you." Now, in its setting, back in its day, it was very simple. Today, it's not so simple. The word faith has grown all of this moss around it. And our great need is to kind of go back and find out what it actually means. And let me try and put it together like this. Faith isn't a blind leap in the dark. Faith isn't a religious experience where you just put away all the evidence to the contrary and just believe. Faith is the only reasonable response to the evidence before you. The evidence of who Jesus is. When you see who Jesus is, why were you ever afraid? Do you see? Why are you still astonished? You should know me and know how to respond to me in confidence and trust. In fact, that's what the word faith just means. It's a Greek word that can be translated belief, confidence, trust, reliance on. Our English word faith has got so many other things. You just put the word trust and you get the sense of what it means. You people of little confidence. You people of little trust in me. Now, there is one other occasion where the New Testament uses the word faith differently. It uses it of the faith once delivered. And there the word faith just means the body of doctrine, the theology that's been passed down. Because faith is so integral to the Christian faith that it be called the faith, do you see? But here's the deal. Faith is just the word trust. And you are exercising faith right now in this building. You're all sitting here not without a thought to the fact that the roof might fall in. Well, unless, I don't know, some of you sweating at the moment. But, you're sitting, you've walked in here, great confidence. And you've got confidence, you've got faith in the building not falling down because of all kinds of evidences. Because of the engineer who designed it, which might help or not, I don't know. But you know how the codes of Australia work. You know how the inspectors function and all regulations. You know the kind of experience around the country of safety that we've exhibited again and again. So you walk into a building with lots of evidence to enable you to have confidence, to have faith that it won't fall down. The point of the whole book of Matthew is that you might be given enough information to know that Jesus is who he says he is, and that you might therefore respond rightly by trusting him, by putting your confidence in him, by having faith in him. You know, God in his grace knows how human we are, how we need evidence. He's made us rational creatures who properly need to see the evidence of the truth before we accept that it is true. He's made us this way. And so he arrives in human history down through the Old Testament with all of these evidences of his hand at work, his promises that get fulfilled, his promises that get fulfilled, his judgments that come, just as he said, that are all meant to build in us a confidence that the God of the Bible is the true and living God. And then he makes a whole series of promises so that when he arrives in the flesh, he fulfills all those promises and we know who Jesus is. Matthew himself regularly talks about how Jesus fulfills the Old Testament. You get it there in chapter 8, verse 17, how he fulfills the prophet Isaiah 53, taking up our infirmities and bearing our diseases, in receiving in himself the sicknesses of others and healing them and so on. It's an extraordinary thing. But Matthew brings all of this to us that we might actually have good reason to see who Jesus is and trust him. You know, there's a beautiful thing that you see in all of this that should be straightforward. That if you see Jesus for who he is, you will have confidence. There are some surprises, though, in the text. Let me just take you through a couple of them to give a quick sense of it. But it's the simple thing straightforward. There are a couple of surprises. Look at chapter 8, the very first episode, the leprosy. We passed over that. Let me just touch on it very briefly. Verse 2, a man with leprosy came and knelt before him and said, Lord, if you are willing, you can make me clean. Jesus reached out his hand and touched the man. I am willing, he said, be clean, and immediately cleansed of his leprosy. Just a couple of surprising things there. First is this, faith does not mean not using if. Some people have a notion of faith as the power of positive thinking, and if the power of positive thinking is what faith is, then you can't use the word if. You just have such confidence that you name what you want and claim it to be yours. There's no if involved. And if there's an if involved, it means you don't have sufficient faith and you won't get it. But here you have the leper who comes if. If you're willing, you can make me clean. And Jesus gives him what he asks for. Because the problem with the word if is not the willing piece, it's the can piece. It is a problem if you come to Jesus saying, if you can, of course he can. That's a lack of faith. If you come saying, I know you can, and I'm asking whether you will, that's humility. Properly appropriate. that you come to the Lord of the universe asking, not demanding. Asking in his goodness that he might not. He might choose, because of a greater purpose, greater plan, to not grant your request. And we need to recognize that about our good God. There's something of a surprise. It's the Lord who heals, not my faith that makes it happen. But then you get verse 3, another surprise. Jesus reached out his hand and touched the man. I am willing, be clean. Did Jesus need to touch the leper for him to be clean? No. The centurion, his servant, is healed without Jesus even, almost doesn't even say anything, does it? Verse 13, let it be done just as you believed it would be. Doesn't need to touch to heal. Why does he touch the leper? Because right here you have a revelation that the God of the universe who becomes flesh reveals himself to be compassionate, who knows our humanity, who knows our deeper needs. And the leper had not just a need for healing, but a need for care, love, together with you in this. And so Jesus touches the man, a man who probably hadn't been touched for years. Do you know that about your God? He is with you in your weaknesses. It's a beautiful thing to learn and see and experience. I'll give you another surprise on the other end, actually. The other surprise is on the end of Jesus' greatness. The centurion shows us this. Verse 5 of chapter 8, when Jesus had entered Capernaum, a centurion came to him asking for help. Lord, he said, my servant is at home paralyzed, suffering terribly. Do you know who centurions are? Centurions are Roman officers. They ruled over how many men? 80 to 100 or so. And they were meant to be out in front in the battle. They were meant to lead their men by example. Their life was 25 years in the army, killing people. And here's a man who commanded others. He's a man of command. Now, you know what they look like because you've done history. You've looked at Gladiator, the movie. And you've I like to think of Russell Crowe, but taller, all right? And these are big, strong men, okay? And that man comes to Jesus for help. And he calls Jesus Lord. Do you know what kind of other man would cause a man like that to come for help? Whenever I've not seen many movies with Jesus in them, but whenever I've seen movies where Jesus is portrayed, 2,000 years of church life have domesticated Jesus. He always looks like, you know, flowing robes and long, shiny hair that's kind of buffy and soft, gentle face that's doughy eyes and a beautiful, serene smile. He looks kind of effeminate. Just remember, Jesus was a man who spent his life breaking timber for a living before builders became soft. Talk to me later. Do you know what I mean? Jesus didn't have power tools. Do you know what I mean? He didn't kind of get the circular saw out and it all had to be done by hand. He didn't get the power plane and had to do it all by hand and cart all that. Didn't get the nail gun out and around the place. I bought a nail gun second hand. It's the best tool I've ever bought, I've got to tell you. Kids. But you're talking about Jesus. Jesus is the man who there was something about this Jesus that a centurion comes and bows the knee before him. Comes like a child trusting him. In the storm, Jesus stands up and says, quiet, be still. And nature hears him. Do you know Jesus is like this? You have a look there in chapter 8, verse 18. You see something of this expressed in the way Jesus talks with others. When Jesus saw the crowd around him, he gave orders to cross to the other side of the lake. Then a teacher of the law came to him and said, teacher, I will follow you wherever you go. Now, how should Jesus, gentle Jesus, meek and mild, have responded to that? Oh, that's so wonderful. I need people to follow me. Good on you. Let's join together. What does Jesus actually say? Foxes have dens, birds have nests, but the Son of Man has no place to lay his head. You've got no clue what you're saying. And I'm not in this for your needs. I'm not in this to be needed by. I don't need you. Another disciple said to him, "First, let me go bury my father." Gentle Jesus, meek and mild, would have said, "Oh, of course, you've got other important things to do. You must go and do that as well." The true Jesus says, "Follow me and let the dead go and bury their dead. There is nothing more important than you following me. I won't let anyone stand between me and you." This is a Jesus who is God come in the flesh, who doesn't need us, who doesn't speak to us with this kind of desperate need for our approval. Realize who you're engaging with, who is gentle, who does touch the leper, but touches the leper as the Lord of the universe. Faith is not a soft religious thing. It is the natural response to that which is proven faithful. Faith is to believe the truth about who Jesus is and to put your trust in him, not yourself. And the point of the book is to build our faith, our convictions of who he is, that we might grow in our confidence in him. In this sense, faith is cultivated not by looking in, but by looking out. By looking outside to the reality outside of us that doesn't change with your circumstances, that doesn't change with your feelings, that is true irrespective. I talked with a lady after 8:30, wonderful, who's gone through all kinds of things, and she said, "It's easy to look to circumstances and wonder about God, but when you look to Jesus, you see the reality, the objective, concrete truth of who he is, and I'm bolstered and strengthened to have confidence, to have faith." Is that you this morning? You know, two women responding after church. Not in our church, somewhere else. One was thrilled by all the emotions of church, the energy, the things that were going on inside her, and she was bubbling over, talking about how amazing all the experiences all were. Another lady is sitting quietly in the chair. The pastor comes up to her and says, "Are you okay? Did you not like church this morning?" And she says, "I wasn't thinking about church. I was thinking about Jesus. And I'm in awe. I'm struck by his power, his majesty, his glory. I'm humbled. I realize I have no other hope but him. I'm praying for his work that he might strengthen my confidence. I'm sobered by all of it. And I just can't quite move yet until I process it." Which woman has got it? Possibly both. The first lady might well have got it. And what she's excited by is to see brothers and sisters around her stirred by the truth of Jesus in the singing, stirred by the truth of Jesus in the words proclaimed. And those things stir her to look to Jesus as well. She just expresses it in the way you've got to be careful, don't you? But the warning I want to offer is this, that we don't do church that you might love church. We want you to get to the place where you don't even notice church. You don't notice the preachers. What you notice is Jesus. That you are drawn week by week through the singing, through the words, through the fellowship together, to see the glory and greatness of Jesus, that you might be drawn outside of yourself and put your faith in him and want to become more like him, that you might grow in your faith in him. You know, one of the great things about singing together, I find so encouraging and stirring, is when I know people are actually singing out of a love for Jesus, I'm stirred to love him more. Isn't that right? This matters, brothers and sisters, because Jesus says there'll be those who are cast out who should have been in. How do you know that you won't be cast out? The key is, do you see Jesus for who he is? And have you put your confidence in him as your only hope? Let's pray that's the case. Heavenly Father, we do ask, please, that you might Stir in us, by your Holy Spirit, a confidence in the person and work of Jesus, that we might grow more and more to see him and not ourselves, that we might be encouraged by all the things that go on in church life. So many work so hard to actually look beyond ourselves to see Jesus. That you might please let it be the case that no one amongst us lives without confidence and trust and faith in Jesus. And we ask it in his name, for our sake, for his glory. In Jesus' name, amen.